This episode is sponsored by the Academy of Therapy Wisdom. Renowned for offering premier trauma online training programs, Therapy Wisdom is not just an educational platform, but an engaged and thriving community. It's a community where mental health professionals gather to learn from the foremost experts in trauma treatment through an array of courses, workshops, and seminars. This month, they're presenting an exceptional opportunity, a complimentary live training titled Helping Trauma Survivors Get Unstuck, a Fragmented Selves Approach in Therapy, featuring the esteemed Dr. Janina Fisher. For those unfamiliar, Janina is a venerated clinical psychologist and global authority on trauma and dissociation, as well as this year's recipient of the Psychotherapy Networker's Lifetime Achievement Award. This webinar serves as an introduction to her comprehensive course, Healing the Fragmented Selves of Trauma Survivors, and which lays the groundwork for her Trauma-Informed Stabilization Treatment Certification Program. I wholeheartedly encourage you to join Janina's transformative free live webinar. Secure your spot by visiting therapywisdom.com/training. Don't let this chance to elevate your practice slip by. Explore more about the Academy of Therapy Wisdom either by visiting therapywisdom.com/training or by clicking the link in our show notes. Once again, go to therapywisdom.com/training. The Center for Healing Trauma and Attachment, or CATA, founded by the visionary Doreen Hills, is dedicated to providing innovative and compassionate treatment for those seeking profound healing. CATA's mission is clear: to offer driven, passionate, and cutting-edge therapeutic approaches that not only heal trauma, but also address the needs of the soul. They believe that true healing goes beyond symptom management and is about restoring wholeness. So whether you're an individual seeking therapy, a provider or a therapist looking for training, or a member of the community in need of support, CATA offers quality and affordable trainings tailored to your unique needs. To learn more, visit chtainc.org. That's chtainc.org. Trauma Therapist Podcast, episode 458. All right, guys, welcome to the Trauma Therapist Podcast. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, like I am, you're going to have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, and set up recurring or one-time chores, all customized to your family's needs. When I was a kid, I had to do chores. Had money been transferred afterwards as a result, I think I would have had so much more motivation. All the while, your kids are learning to build financial literacy and independence. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/traumatherapist. That's greenlight.com/traumatherapist to try Greenlight for free. Once again, go to greenlight.com/traumatherapist. My name is Guy McPherson. My mission is to raise awareness of trauma and to support new trauma therapists just starting out on their trauma-informed journey. I do that through this podcast and my membership community, Trauma Therapist 2.0. If you're a therapist of any kind, interested in learning about trauma, and you're looking for support and inspiration, I invite you to check out Trauma Therapist 2.0 by going to traumatherapist2.com. That's Trauma Therapist, the number 2.com. All right, let's get started. This episode is sponsored by cptsdfoundation.org. And one of the great things about, for me, about doing this podcast is that I get to speak to and work with amazing people. And Athena Moberg, the CEO and founder of cptsdfoundation.org, is one of those individuals. This woman is on fire. I got to meet her several months ago here in San Francisco. We had breakfast together and just had a really great talk. And I got to learn about her foundation and what they're doing. They provide complex trauma survivors and practitioners with compassionate support, skills, and trauma-informed education. Athena works together with expert practitioners and treatment centers, offering daily touch points to anyone currently in trauma therapy or who wants a safe place to come, feel heard and validated between therapy appointments. Some of the resources they offer are daily recovery support, a healing book club. They have free support groups. They also offer this really cool thing where they can
send you texts just to encourage you and help you heal on your journey. So check them out at cptsdfoundation.org/traumatherapistpodcast. Once again, that's cptsdfoundation.org/traumatherapistpodcast. All right, folks, welcome back to the Trauma Therapist Podcast. Guy McPherson here. And today, I am joined with, by Paula Joyce and June Kavanaugh, the Kavanaugh sisters. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here.
So the Kavanaugh sisters were born into a large family of 10 children in the mid-1950s and 60s in a disadvantaged area of Dublin, where their father sexually abused each of them for over two decades. In 1989, they made the decision to bring charges against their father, and in 1990, the Irish state took a successful case against him. He was convicted and sentenced to a term of 7 years, though was released having served five of those years. In 1992, the sisters took part in a groundbreaking RTE documentary series entitled Tuesday File, Silent Scream, that was produced by Moya Doherty. Up to that point, RTE programs on child abuse always had the interviewees' faces hidden and voices distorted. But they openly volunteered to share their story, and despite the attempted injunction by their imprisoned father, the documentary was aired on RTE in October 1992. The program went on to win a Jacobs Award in 1992, and early the next year, the sisters were nominated for the Harvey's Sunday Independent Irish Woman of the Year. The program also went on to be used as a training tool for professionals dealing with abuse victims and won the U.S. National Women's Studies Association Award in 1994. All right, ladies, once again, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks.
So before we get going here, share with our listeners where you're from and where you're calling from now.
We are all from Dublin originally, and we're actually calling from Dublin. June and Joyce both live in Dublin still, and okay. I live down the country in Cavan, so. Not too far.
Okay. So, you know, before we started recording, you said that, you're open to talking about anything. So I just want to put it out there for people, you know, before we get going here, we may delve into really touchy, sensitive topics that might be the trigger for certain people, and just to use your discretion as you're listening, you know, as we move forth. But what's your mission, would you say, right now?
Well, to encourage the most
and
thing.
And this is Paula speaking. Yes. Okay.
The most thing we want to do is encourage victims to speak out, to tell their story. Doesn't have to be publicly. It certainly doesn't have to be on a podcast or on a radio. But the more you get people to speak up and talk, the less likelihood there will be of this continuing for the next three generations.
Also, for professionals to speak out, because we have huge issues here with the government. It's kind of given the whole subject lip service. They won't really engage. They think they have to feel sorry for you, but they won't actually do anything proactive to stop the issue or to deal with the issue.
And also, we find it helps us to help other people, that it moves us along on our journey, that every time we think we have a handle on the trauma that we went through as a result of the abuse, we discover there's more.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
More layers to it. Mm. And only by continuing the work we do, we uncover in ourselves what we needed. You know, it's amazing the depths of the impacts of childhood sexual abuse. And it is a lifetime of recovery. And although you will reach a space where you feel somewhat free from the impacts, you're never done. And it doesn't mean you're walking around suicidal or anything like that. And there are certainly much more good days than bad, but you're never done dealing with it.
It's also, it's constant learning, because every time we discuss anything, we think we're passing on information. And then we discover, too, the conversations we have among ourselves or on the podcast, that, Jesus, that really resonates. So there's still remnants there need to be healed.
I think part of the problem is when you're dealing with trauma from an adult's point of view, it's a very different kind of treatment and therapy they're going to need. If you're dealing with a child who's been abused in their family home in particular, and if it's a parent, that's even more hurtful and damaging. The problem is you don't have the opportunity to develop as a child or develop as a person, because everything you learn from your abuser. So everything you learn about you, about the world you live in, about your community and society, what you should and shouldn't do, all comes from a negative person. So what we found when we start writing the first book, for instance, we found we had to rebuild. We actually had to start building us as people right from the start, because we had nowhere to go back to. There wasn't a before or after. There was always abuse.
So we had no idea who we were. We had to actually discover and develop our own personalities and start from scratch.
So how old were you when...
So the grooming began from...
Well, no. Well, I want to ask you a different question before that. When you guys got to a point where you're like, holy shit, this is going on. Who told who? Because I imagine that things were going on. You didn't talk about it.
Never.
But it got to a point...
The only reason I believe that we ever really spoke to each other about it is because how my father ended up going to prison was it was discovered that he had abused a grandniece of his. Now, I was 25 at the time this all came out, and we had never had an in-depth conversation about anything. We never talked about abuse whatsoever. But when this came out, we didn't really want to go down the line of putting him in jail. We just wanted him to go away. So we tried to get him committed. We tried every avenue other than going to the police. And then in the end, we were told we had no other option to take him off the streets and out of danger was to put him in jail. But it was only then that we actually started talking and engaging with each other and talking about what had happened to each of us. Because the thing about abuse in a home is, regardless of how many people are there or...
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Regardless of any victims are there, each victim feels they're the only one. So I was convinced I was the only one. And that was because he didn't like me, and that's why I was being abused. And the girls had very different reasons for thinking they were the only one.
And it was only through the process of writing our first book that we would go away and write an individual experience of abuse, just to find somewhere to begin on this healing journey. And we'd come back together and we discovered, as we'd be relaying our stories to each other, we might say something like, he walked in the room and clicked his fingers and I would freeze and hope it wasn't me. And we were saying, well, who did you think it was? And then we realized we all knew about each other, but it was an unwritten rule. It was a level of knowing that wasn't in your full consciousness. It was there. We all knew it, but nobody ever admitted that or realized it.
When we first start talking about the abuse and we first start talking to different groups about the abuse, the one thing everybody seems to struggle really hard with is understanding how could it go on in a house and we not know about it. And we have really struggled to try and explain that to people, that when you're in a survival mode, which children are, especially in trauma, when you're in that survival mode, you only see and know and register what matters to get you through the day. So, and I remember when we went back and discussed it and wrote about it, I remember loads of times walking in and catching my father raping somebody else. But I can tell you, as soon as I left the room, that was gone. That was filed away. I never thought about it again. And I was still convinced I was the only one being raped. And that can be a really difficult concept for people to get their head around. Even us. Yeah.
Yeah, well, there are obviously so many issues and layers to the story in terms of how trauma manifests, the how it impacts the brain and the body, how you guys dealt with it, you know, your story of how you survived and how abuse, continues to go on in a household.
We grew up believing we were stupid. We all suffered badly in school. We didn't have any capacity to learn, and we'd that confirmed for us, and our father constantly told us we were stupid. So we grew up believing that, and that went really deep. But when we start writing, as I said, we uncovered the fact that we were fully loaded. You know, our fight or flight was on 24/7. There was no more room for anything else. We knew what to expect in our home. It was horrible. It was abusive. I mean, but it was familiar.
The contradiction was it was the only place we ever felt safe.
That's right.
It's
crazy.
Right.
And so school, that was an added expectation. You were expected to learn. We'd no room left for that. And so that confirmed for us that we were stupid. We didn't recognize. We never connected the dots. We never connected any of our behaviours, good, bad or indifferent, with our abuse. It's only through the work that we do that we realise that absolutely everything we did was connected to survival and the impacts.
When you started talking about this with each other, can you share the story of how did you get treatment? Did you get therapy? Did you say we need help? What was that process like?
We did actually sign up for therapy.
About a year before the abuse,
but there was a huge waiting list. And once we signed up, that's the energy gone, right? So we didn't chase it up on it and we didn't follow up. But when we knew we had to do a court case, we rang them again and explained the situation. So they rushed us, speed us through. But we had no idea what was facing us. And we had no understanding of what we expected to happen in that sessions. But we did I was very naive and I believed they were going to fix me. And yet I couldn't tell you what was broken.
We all did. We thought 4 weeks tops and we're sorted. They're going to fix us and we'd be grand.
And I also, I really believed I was going to come out a whole new person.
Yeah.
And at that time I was really struggling with my sexuality and coming out about being gay. So my mother was convinced when I went into therapy I'd come out normal. So I wouldn't be gay anymore because that was actually all down to the abuse. There was so many different confusing things happened. And nobody actually told us when we went into therapy, hang on for a second, you actually have to engage in this process and you really have to do the work. We didn't think that for a second. We thought it was somebody else's job, not ours.
But the truth of the matter is when Joyce made a phone call a year before the abuse came out to a rape crisis centre and put our names down, the fact that we didn't hear from them again, if this didn't happen, if the abuse didn't come out within the family, we would have never reconnected again. That was all. Most victims get a
spurt
of
a trigger.
Yeah, of I don't know what
courage. It's like I'm going to do them.
They reach out for help. If the help isn't there, you may never reach them again. And so, just so happens that within our family, when the abuse came out, Joyce was able to reconnect with them and they'd no idea who we were. They'd lost our names, but because the case was coming up, they put us up on their list. But it's a disgrace the amount of time people have to wait here. There's so many people going to their graves, you know, suffering unnecessarily. It's not there.
I mean, just the fact that, you know, you're dealing with this, you know, horrific abuse enshrouded in secrecy and silence within a culture, right? That almost perpetuates that. The fact that you were able to put your foot down in a sense and speak and get help. I mean, my God, inspiring is that?
It was circumstances that we kind of fell along with.
We were kind of pushed into it. We didn't never put our hands up and said, listen, we're great, we're going to do this. There was no bravery or courage. We didn't see it like that because it was forced on us.
Yeah.
As I said, he raped somebody else. They came forward. They tried to commit suicide. So in two investigations, it was discovered. And then the idea was that when his family told my mother, the plan was he was to get help, but that's as far as to go.
And he went of his own volition and signed himself into a mental institution, thinking he would bide his time and then come back home and everything would be forgotten about. But we were called into that institution by one of the doctors, and she couldn't fathom him at all. She said, he's walking around here like nothing has ever happened. He's writing fairy stories, which would be typical of him. He was unbelievable.
He was creative.
And, yeah. She said, he's coming in, he's doing writing. He's coming in and asking for her opinion on this writing, that he's writing this children's book. Like, he was away with the birds. But she couldn't.
He firmly believed we could never have coped without him.
Yeah. And that's why they called us up, because she said, we're a bit concerned, because he reckons he practically made out that we couldn't get out of bed in the morning without him. And you can imagine how we responded.
Our situation was a little bit different than other people's, in the fact that the abuse happened in the home by my father, but we also all worked for my father. We had a business attached onto the house. It was a shop, and then it was a factory, and we did many different things, but we worked for him as well as him being the abuser. He controlled your finances, your opportunities in life. There was no area in our life that he didn't have his hand in. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that literally, but it was like, it was just crazy. And that made it even more difficult for us to make the decision of how to get out of it. And I can honestly tell you, the only reason I was putting my hand up to get prosecuted was I just wanted him gone. And I didn't care where he went as long as he wasn't in the house, because I was still living at home at the time. So we didn't feel we did anything out of bravery. We did. And also, we all felt at the time when it went through the courts, we felt we had something that needed to be said. We felt we could change the world, to be honest. When we first came out and did the RTE documentary, we really thought, in our naivety, we were going to stop child abuse. That was going to be it. And we were going to let people know, this is what's happening now, stop doing it. And of course, now we're 35 years later and it hasn't changed, unfortunately.
Where you said you grew up with, what, 7 other siblings?
Yeah. And
where were they? Where was your mother within all of this?
There were 6 boys and 4 girls. Now, the eldest girl, she was the eldest of the family. And by the time, I think she left home at about 19, did she?
Yeah.
She ran away to England because of him as well. And
he sexually abused her too.
Yeah. And the boys, to the best of our knowledge, this sexual abuse didn't occur with them. We're not even sure about that, because it's very hard for boys to come forward. They're proud of us and what we do. But even if he didn't sexually abuse them, he psychologically, physically,
mentally, he did everything he could.
Definitely.
And with the boys, they were kind of older than us. And he was very physically violent with them, more than he would have been with us. Because with us, some people would say he had actually calmed down by the time I would have came along. And it wasn't that he calmed down, he had just got smarter.
Or he got fucking lazy, yeah. Sorry.
The more he got away with it, the braver he became.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming, and it's only an assumption, that with an abuser, what they're getting off on is the thrill and the rush of adrenaline, the whole lot that goes on. And the more he got away with it, braver he got. So he would nearly abuse you in front of somebody and think absolutely nothing of it.
He didn't do that.
I know, it was like that
sense with him. But in terms of the control, he had a job for everybody. He didn't like to see anybody sitting down. So it wasn't like there were people, you know, just lounging around in rooms. That absolutely never would have happened. He had a role for...
He was asking about mommy.
No, he was asking about the siblings.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No.
My mother worked in the grocery shop right beside the house. But the way the grocery shop was set up, remember we lived in a disadvantaged area, and if you blinked, your stuff would be stolen. So she couldn't even go to the toilet without ringing the bell. And somebody had to go out and stay there while she went to the toilet. So there's no way she'd walk in and catch him. So he had complete control over her. And as far as we're concerned, my mother was as much a victim as any of us were.
And at the same time, my mother knew in the same way I knew.
Yeah, she wouldn't have known.
And I wouldn't have been able to figure that out for a long time till I did my own work. Because I was convinced she knew, and I was more angry with her than I was with him. And more angry with her because she wasn't capable of being any way emotional. She certainly wasn't touchy-feely. She wasn't comforting. She just did what she had to do. And I would say she was quite cold and distant. But I now know, and I understand why she did that. That was to protect herself from him.
And right. us.
Yeah.
Because she said over the years, if she showed any affection towards any of the children, he'd make the children suffer. So eventually she just withdrew so much. There was no winning with him. He was a very aggressive, very violent man, very volatile. And over the years, she just withdrew more and more. She had no confidence. He picked her for a reason because he could control her. But he got to the point where she just shut her emotions off for protection. She had a wall around her protection, around her heart, but good couldn't get in either. Like she wasn't just sealing out the bad, nothing could get in. And so she was completely unavailable to us emotionally.
And to herself.
Yeah. And bad and all as he was all we had, you know.
Right, right. Let me just jump in here for a second and just remind everyone that I'm speaking with Paula Joyce and June Kavanaugh. Their website is thekavanaughsisters.com. That's the Kavanaugh is K-A-V-A-N-A-G-H sisters.com. Can you each talk a little bit about the therapy or treatment or healing that you each individually went through, what that was like?
Well, and when we were writing the book, we really struggled with how to put the therapy end of our treatment into the book because it wasn't all good. And for me, I certainly wouldn't say it was a positive experience because at the time when we started therapy, it was really new in Ireland. Like the practice of treating adult sexual abuse survivors was still really new and in its early stages. So it was kind of like they were learning the same way we were learning. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have a positive experience because the lack of resources. When I went into therapy, I got immediately thrown into a group setting with 14 other women who were falling apart, and that didn't suit me. Right. But I wouldn't have known at the time I had a right to say, hang on for a second, I would prefer to have a one-on-one. It was different for all of us because June preferred to be in a group than do the one-on-one. So we all had very different experiences and very limited experience. And plus, it was down to money. At one stage, we were literally working to pay for therapy. And that's where all our money went, was to go and get help. It was a difficult process. But where we really got our therapy, in all honesty, was writing the books.
Hold on. So this is Paula, you're speaking right now. So I hear you talking about, you know, not all therapy was good, and certainly at that time. And in Ireland, of course, with that culture, writing helped you. Talk specifically, Paula, about the process. What helped you in the writing? All right, guys, just quickly, I want to thank Century Motors Psychotherapy Institute for being a sponsor on this podcast. Do you struggle to help numb disconnected clients who can't feel emotion or explore inner experience? Learn a comprehensive approach to conceptualize your client's concerns. You know, as someone who's gone through the level one and level two trainings of sensory motor psychotherapy training, I can really speak to the power of this training. For me, it was a game changer and is so inspiring. Sensory motor psychotherapy uniquely includes the body and therapy as both a source of information and a target for intervention because words are not enough. Go beyond theories and gain practical ways to open a new dimension for effective therapy. Visit Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute online today at sensorymotor.org. That's sensorymotor.org.
When we first started writing the fourth book, Click Click, we decided, and it was a conscious decision we made, that we would write and tell the story from the place of the child, and we'd put the child's voice into it. That in itself was quite challenging. So it did take us over 20 years to write this book because it brought up so much stuff that we used to have to go away for years and then come back. But what we would do is, say I would be at home and I'd write a memory. I'd write, say, about my Holy Communion being raped on the day, and I would do it from the eyes of me as a child. Mm. Then I would come back and I'd give it to the girls. We'd read it. And reading it out loud is even more difficult than actually writing it. And then there would be a critique about, were you present? Did you stay present when you were writing that? What did that really feel like? You haven't got enough emotional in there, or so whatever. So we would go through the process like that. But the one thing I found that benefited me most from writing was when I went in and wrote from the child's point of view about a memory in detail, that was where I found my freedom, as strange as that may sound. Because when I went in, I was actually able to see me as a child and see my innocence, see how I was manipulated, the fear and the trauma that I went through at that present moment of being raped. All of that came very visible to me, and it took a long time, and it was with a lot of heartache. But it was actually where I found my freedom, because it was the first time in my life I was able to go in and see my actual innocence and see me as a child who was abused, as opposed to what I had taught up to then, that I was responsible and I was,
right, it was right. Me. Wow, and, very powerful. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing
that. It's the only crime where the victim takes the responsibility, holds all the shame, holds all the guilt. I don't know what it is about this crime, but it's the only crime where that actually happens. And in the writing, as Paula says, to be able to write as a child about an incident that happened, it does allow you to see the innocence, which you wouldn't have even been aware of before the writing, but to allow yourself to see the innocence of the child and all the child wanted, in my case, was just to be loved. I wanted to please him so he'd love me. So it's crazy. And even learning that, it still took a long time to actually let it sink in and to own that. And then comes the self-forgiveness and the self-understanding. But again, that takes time. But that's basically what we got from writing the first book. Mm-hmm.
So this is Joyce speaking now. So Joyce, what about your own process, your own therapy, your healing? What did you take on? What worked for you?
Well, the process of therapy for me, it kind of went along with my personality. I would have been extremely obedient. And I always believed if I did what they told me, because they are better and they know more than me, that I would be, well, one, they'd like me. And one, I'd be cured, whatever that was going to look like. So I did a lot of things I was told to do without question. You know, when I look back and I can tell you, some of it was nearly as harmful and traumatic as the abuse itself. But it was an experimental period. And even in all the negative things, I would say to you, the therapy put us on the right path. It got us to actually start looking at ourselves and learning more. And we learned more after the process than during. But it wasn't a good experience. I wouldn't go around bragging about it. They've learned that so much more has changed since then. But it was experimental. It was a new kind of crime. Because up to then, Rape Crisis Centre dealt with rape, not childhood rape. So this was all new to them. So, you know, as I said, I do believe what I learned through that process put me on the path of self-discovery. But, you know, the whole process, I always remember they taught you all was about integration. I had no idea what integration looked like or how the hell that would happen. So that was a huge thing. And even at the end of the council, after years now, I remember thinking, yeah, great. Like, they're telling me I'm cured, but I don't feel any different. Mm. I'm no more in touch with myself now than I was at the beginning of the process.
And in some ways, at times we felt worse than when...
Well, like, I felt, again, there's another expectation. I'm expected now to feel cured, whatever that looks like. And I didn't feel that. So I felt, again, I was disappointed in me. That me wasn't good enough. I wasn't worthy. So in that sense, it wasn't good.
Thank you for that. How about for you, June?
Well, they've kind of covered it now. But I would also say that when I left, I did feel, right, that is great, but nobody has actually touched on the problem. And it took years for me to realize the problem was an accumulation of every rape, every hurt, every slight that joined together to form what I thought was me on the inside. I thought I was such a horrible person. I thought I had the blackest soul that nobody could actually help me because I couldn't even access it myself. I couldn't tell anybody what it was. I just felt it represented me. And it was the self-hatred that had, I could nearly draw it on my body. I felt I could see it. When I took a breath, I could feel it. And I thought it was just who I was. And that's what I went for help for. I didn't know that that was even anything to do with the abuse. I didn't know that. I just thought that was me. So when I finished the counselling and that still wasn't gone, I was sorely disappointed. And it wasn't until we wrote both books. It's been a long journey.
You'll say.
And you've moved her to tears.
I'm looking at you folks. I mean, some people are going to be hearing this. Some will be watching this video. But for those of you who are just listening, the three of you just seem so close.
Oh, we've had our problems, I can absolutely tell you. And writing the books really was a challenge because we've grown throughout the process. And to get three strong women in the same room to agree on a paragraph is an absolute nightmare. Now, it really was, but we got through it because we all have the same mission. We strongly believe in what we're doing. And we also believe this is the reason we're here. And it's given us a purpose, a reason to be alive and to help other people. And inadvertently, it's helping us too.
It was, I kind of think when we were writing the second book and we were, it's like June said, even after we'd done all the therapy, we had accepted certain things were just who we were. So we were just faulty coming out of manufacturers and you would just have to live with that. But when we were writing the second book and we understood, and then we did research and we found different issues we were having in our lives that we'd have a talk about, and we knew we all were sharing the same issue. Say it was we weren't very good going out in social settings, or we found it really, the anxiety was just overwhelming. When we researched and found out social anxiety is an actual thing and the therapists all know about it, and then we were able to connect our own lives and put it into that and go, my God, that we all have that disorder and we all have that condition.
We had every condition in the book, and we didn't know there was a name for it. We didn't know there's research out there that this has been, known for years, and not only known for years, but also associated with sexual abuse victims. So over time, we didn't reinvent the wheel. We just culminated it all in one place together. And as our lives, as we started to dissect the problems we each had, we would be discussing it to the nth degree. And then Paula, the researcher, would kick in and she'd say, listen, there's actually a condition for that. And we're going, fuck, So it was like everything we had, social anxiety, attachment disorder, complex PTSD, dissociation, compartmentalization. Jesus, we couldn't do, the list was longer than our arms.
And in fairness, the important thing about having that information and having it close to hand, what it does for victims of abuse, in particular what it did for us, but what it will do for any victim of any trauma, especially childhood trauma, is let you know you're not insane, that what you're feeling, what you're doing, your behaviours, your attitudes, your thought processes are all normal considering what you're trying to come out of. That was huge for us. If we'd have known this when we started, it would have taken years of self-hatred, shame, guilt, and it would have removed it. Just simply by knowing it.
Self-hatred is the killer. That's absolutely the killer. And absolutely, if we had the information we have now, absolutely years of self-hatred would have been saved.
A lot of therapists of all types are going to be listening to this. A lot of survivors listen to this. And I know that each of you, talked about your experience with therapy and what it was like in that time. But what would you say to the therapist listening to this that they need to hear? They should know. Joyce, you're stepping in there.
No, I'd say the first thing is I don't care how old the client is that approached you. Just remember, if they were abused at two, that's how old they are in front of you. And this stupid fucking question of how do you feel, that I found that really annoying, because one, I couldn't tell you how I felt. I didn't know how I felt. I couldn't articulate that. And that all that did was tell me, my dad was right. I was stupid. I am stupid. I can't even answer the simplest question.
So here you are also being told you're stupid in therapy.
Yeah.
Because you're given this question that you can't even answer.
No. And the nodding.
And the therapists who like to do this, to let you know they're listening. Oh my God, you have no idea how many therapists are wanting to rip their head off their shoulders. It's like that. It
feels patronizing. Yeah.
And again,
so just nodding. For those who can't see, just nodding.
Knowing look on their face and just smiling as much as to say, You fucking idiot.
I think the therapist needs to understand that their job and their role is to listen, to get me to talk and make an environment safe enough for me to speak and hold my story and give it back to me in bite-sized pieces when I'm ready for it. I think that's your job. I think trying to go in there and tell me that I need to have all the answers right from the get-go, or sit there in silence for an hour, which I did in many of my therapy sessions that I paid big money for.
Yeah.
That is really annoying. That's not helpful. If I can't speak, it's not because I'm choosing to sit there and say nothing. I can't speak because I don't know how to find the words. And I think a therapist has to help you.
Well, emotional intelligence is usually with childhood developmental issue, like with childhood sexual abuse, there are definitely, there's a lack of emotional intelligence. We thought we were virgins when we were being, and we were raped on an almost daily basis. We really didn't have a clue what was happening to us. And so to ask, you know, because there are certain episodes of abuse that stand out in your mind that were really horrific, and they're the extra trauma that you get stunted at. So you could be stuck at age 2, 4, 7, so that you're fragmented and you've got this fragmented, emotionally unintelligent child in front of you, and you're going, well, how does that feel? And you're sitting nodding, like, and it's just so disarming. You feel like you have to perform, you have to be good for this person, and you feel nearly like rehearsing what to say before you go in. That's not therapy, you know. And there was another issue that we thought really affected us was the handing over of money for therapy. And I understand, well, of course, we believe it should be government funded, but in the situation where it's not and money is going to exchange hands, that should be organised in such a way it's maybe handed in to a secretary or the person in an envelope before the event. If you're after having a particularly difficult session and you're brokenhearted and you're sobbing, and then you've got to pull yourself together, hand your money over and leave this. Fuck it.
It really impacts you. And also, like, paying for it impacts you anyway, because what you feel is, this person doesn't care about me any more than anybody else. I'm just paying them to care for me. So there has to be a way of managing that payment system where it doesn't even come into the play when you're in that room.
Right,
so
right.
It's not even on your mind or on the therapist's mind. It's a completely separate transaction.
Because you hate yourself and you're sitting there going, she doesn't like me. She thinks I'm stupid.
And but hang on, I'm going to pay her for that now.
Yeah.
Right, right. In terms of your message, and I know it's difficult just to, you know, put these in sound bites, and I'm not expecting that, but what would you like to say to people who are going through this, who maybe aren't able yet to speak up, to say, you know what, I need help?
Yeah, there seems to be a worldwide shift in terms of sexual abuse.
Yeah, but for those that can't.
No, I think the most important thing is to know that there's light at the end of the tunnel, even though the tunnel seems to go on and on, but there is light at the end of it. But the only way you'll ever make sense of your life is by understanding what's going on for you. And the sad thing is, the only way you know that is go in there and have a look. There's no quick fix and there's no easy fix to this, but you can absolutely pick up on lessons from people who've gone before you, from other people who've gone through the journey. All it is to make you realise that you're normal, that what you're feeling is normal, and that you're not a horrible person.
I think there's hope now. When we came out with our abuse, it was like a death sentence. It was nearly no hope for you. You weren't going to recover. And that was just all there was. Because nobody understood it. And they still don't. But I feel now, and I know this is going to sound self-promoting, but I feel there's hope now. I feel we're after getting a lot of the answers we were seeking. So we're able to move along. And if we're sharing everything we learn, we're sharing. So if we can do it, everybody else can. I just believe, like, what we're doing is meant to be shared with others. So I just don't feel like it's a death sentence anymore. I just feel the information is there. Don't give up on yourself. And just keep moving forward, trying your best to get help wherever and however you can.
Here's the thing I think therapists could benefit from. If you're putting out information for victims of abuse and trauma, you have to take into account that a lot of people really suffered with education as a result of their abuse, because your energy goes into surviving and not to learning. So you can really struggle with education and getting to attain a certain level of education. So putting out textbooks with the language in it that's not attainable for people, or not putting it in the context of somebody's actual day-to-day life, can be of absolutely no benefit to other victims. It has to be written in a way that people who have only attained a certain level of education can access that information and realize they're not stupid. This is just one of the issues they have to manage and deal with.
Right, right. So let's kind of shift gears here as we kind of wind down. Your most recent book, talk a little bit about that. Why did you write that one?
Well, if we didn't do the first one, we'd have never got to this, because we didn't realize that this existed. The second book is more like a self-help book.
And the second one is titled Click, Click?
Why Go Back?
Why Go Back? I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. The first book is called Click, Click, because that's how our father used to summon us. He would click his fingers. And that book was like our story. It's our pain. We purged. We got a lot of benefit from writing that book. And when it was done, it's a great book. But when it was done, we realized we're still in shit.
Well, it was actually because we did a lot of talks around schools and women's groups and whatever, and people asked us questions that we couldn't answer. But they were saying that you should write another book. And we're saying, like, what? That's our life. We've nothing else to write about.
Yeah.
But when we actually started investigating ourselves, like, we were just shocked that the amount of shit we still held, we didn't have the answers to. And we realized people need answers. So we started, and we didn't think this was going to be a big deal either, because this only took 6 years, wasn't it? But we couldn't believe what we learned about ourselves. And it's very difficult. If you were raped today and you have to go on and deal with that, at least you have somebody you were before the rape.
Right.
But if you're raped as a child, you have to rediscover. You don't have to rediscover. You have to actually
build
somebody. You know, there's no before that you can go back to your old self, because there was never an old self. But it's much easier to learn something than to unlearn. And what we learned as children was we were stupid, worthless, and we just had to be obedient if we wanted to be accepted and loved. You had to behave in a particular way. And that was whatever way adults wanted you to behave.
And the damage goes so deep. There's absolutely no way you're getting out of this quickly. There's no way. Like, I mean, it did take us 20 years to write the first book, but looking at the condition we were in, we can look back now and think it was a miracle we got that book done at all. Because
And in fairness, we didn't write for 20 years. A lot of the years we had to just put it back because it was so painful and so deep. And
I kind of feel like it's like when you're born into a home where there's going to be abuse, where the sexual abuse is happening by a parent. You're given a backpack the day you arrive, and you put your backpack on, and in that backpack goes all the fear, the trauma, the rape, the abuse, the slagging, and everything negative ever happens goes into the backpack. But you've always worn this backpack, so why would you look at it? And why would you take anything out of it? Why would you shed it? So I think by writing our second book, when we were writing that and understood that all the conditions and disorders that we had were related to the stuff we were carrying in the backpack, we were able to take it off and let it go. But it's only by understanding where the connections are, where your behaviours come from, where you're taught, why you think the way you think. And you'll never question something if you don't realise it's actually not part of you, that it was gifted to you by your abuser. You'll never look at it, because why would you?
But like the abuse itself, the betrayal, the trust, the pain of the abuse, the family impact, your own view of yourself, the self-hatred, the shame, the guilt, the responsibility, that was all in the first book. And we thought, it was like, wow, we've got that done now. And yet our lives were still shit. We were still unhappy. Our relationships weren't brilliant. Our connection even with ourselves only began really through the writing. And people used to say, yous are lucky, like, because you know, we don't have anybody, yous have each other. We didn't really have each other. It's every man for themselves in a household where there's abuse taking place. And the abuser sets that up. But as we sat down and discussed the areas of our life we were unhappy with, we realised, my God, it's the psychological damage that's the killer. All the other stuff, it looks like it's ruining your life,
But when you get it out of the way, you realize that was actually covering, like an iceberg, that was covering the worst of it, which is below the water. And it was absolutely unbelievable to try and get through. But as I said, we feel we've found answers now. And once you can understand your behaviors, you can forgive yourself, have a bit of empathy, and everything changes.
And in fairness, we even feel now we've all got to a place where we forgive my father, we forgive my mother. And that's not just words or lip service. They're no longer featured in our lives. They're no longer an issue for us. We're not carrying around rage or hatred. And that's not to say that you can't still get triggered into a memory or a flashback, but they definitely don't take up energy anymore. They're not there anymore.
But that did take years.
Oh, yeah. You know. And that took the writing of the second book.
Paula, Joyce, and June, Kavanaugh, once again, they can be reached at thekavanaughsisters.com. We'll have them linked up here, the show notes page at thetraumatherapistpodcast.com, along with their most recent book and their books, Click Click and Why Go Back. So aside from your books, what would you recommend, whether trauma related or not?
We were discussing this and we were saying we can't just recommend our own book. But the truth of the matter is, we did read a lot of books similar. Like, we were looking all the time for answers. And we did read a lot of people's stories. And it was reassuring to know you weren't on your own. But other than that, like, we really didn't get a lot of help from books other than realizing you're not on your own.
Yeah, I know. I actually would find that, like, podcasts, especially in this day and age, podcasts are a little bit more useful because they're little sound bites. And you can actually connect with people, because even when you have professionals on your show, the language is toned down. It's not overbearing for people to be able to pick up the message of it.
Right.
I feel that books that helped us were more spiritual. Like,
yeah.
You know, we were...
Well, yeah, just name a couple.
Soul, Gary Zukav was a big one for us. Conversations with God, Neil Donald Walsh.
Wayne Dwyer's books. Who I would recommend...
You Can Heal Your Life.
Yeah. Who I'd recommend most now would be Brené Brown.
Yeah, she's
brilliant. I think she puts it in English and it's simple, easy, and I think you get it. And that's because she relates it to her own life.
And we were a big fan, and still are, of Oprah. So she had all the world thought leaders. And so as soon as we'd see somebody that inspired us, we'd get a book. And they were really the books that did it for us, not so much the autobiographies or anything like that, you know.
But they were good because they did tell you
weren't
on your own.
Yeah.
But that's as much information as you could get.
All right, you three, Paula, Joyce, and June Kavanaugh, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It was enlightening and it was inspiring, and you guys are inspiring.
Thanks very much.
You are. You really are. And the way you articulate your own process that's continuing to go on is, I think a lot of people are going to be impacted by this. So I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks very much for having
us.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
This episode is sponsored by CPTSDFoundation.org. And one of the great things about, for me, about doing this podcast is that I get to speak to and work with amazing people. And Athena Moberg, the CEO and founder of CPTSDFoundation.org, is one of those individuals. This woman is on fire. I got to meet her several months ago here in San Francisco. We had breakfast together and just had a really great talk. And I got to learn about her foundation and what they're doing. They provide complex trauma survivors and practitioners with compassionate support, skills, and trauma-informed education. Athena works together with expert practitioners and treatment centers, offering daily touch points to anyone currently in trauma therapy or who wants a safe place to come, feel heard and validated between therapy appointments. Some of the resources they offer are daily recovery support, a healing book club. They have free support groups. They also offer this really cool thing where they can send you texts just to encourage you and help you heal on your journey. So check them out at cptsdfoundation.org/ Trauma Therapist Podcast. Once again, that's cptsdfoundation.org/Trauma Therapist Podcast.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.